I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
Well, I want to welcome everyone to this episode of The American Idea. Today, we have a problem and we need to talk about it. That is the problem that's been a problem maybe since the American founding, but has certainly accelerated into a very significant issue in public policy, politics, and economics today. And that is the issue of America's national debt. I don't want to depress you right after the holidays, but we got to talk about this issue. And I'm glad to be talking about it with Dave Hebert. Dave is Senior Research Fellow at AIER, the American Institute for Economic Research. He's been formerly a professor at Aquinas College, Troy University, and Ferris State University. He's also been a fellow with the United States Senate Committee on the Budget. And Dave is the author of a really terrific article that just came out in Law and Liberty, a review entitled Realistic Answers to America's Debt Problem. And I think it's an issue that people have talked about, people acknowledge maybe is a problem, but never seem to take it perhaps as seriously as they should. And certainly a lot of people think there's nothing really we can do about it. Dave wants to make a counter argument to that today, and I wanted to have him on The American Idea for that conversation. Dave, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, thanks so much for having me today.
Let's start with the debt problem itself. What is America's debt problem?
Yeah, so right now, the debt problem in the United States is huge. So if you just go to the Treasury's website, they'll tell you that the national debt currently stands at $36.3 trillion with a T, dollars. Now, once we get above billions, you know, people tend to kind of glaze over it and not really understand the magnitude of what we're talking about. And so I like to kind of remind people and say, you know, hey, if you had $1 billion, how far away are you from having a trillion? And the answer is that you're about $1 trillion away from having $1 trillion, even if you had a billion, right? So this is just an astronomically large number. And so it's currently at $36.3 trillion, right? And that's money that we owe to other people in some form. Now, most of it is money that's borrowed from the Federal Reserve. Most of it's in bonds held by the American public or different investing bodies domestically. There are some that are held by China, Japan, Germany has some. So there is foreign debt that's held, but most of it is debt that's held, you know, by the U.S. People. And so the question might be, you know, is this a spending problem or is this a revenue problem, right? Because after all, from an accounting perspective, you know, if you don't have enough money, right, there's two ways to solve this, right? One is by cutting your spending and the other is by increasing revenues. And so when we look at, you know, what is it? Like, which one could it be? An accounting perspective would say, well, there's no way to tell. But if we look at it from an economic perspective and just think about, you know, basically public choice economics in particular, we can see pretty quickly that this is very much a spending problem. For some context, in August of just last year, so just, you know, 4 or 5 months ago, the national debt was a mere $35 trillion, right? And we crossed that barrier on August 1st, and everyone said doom and gloom, and this is terrible. It was a milestone, you know, barrier because it ends in five, and people like fives. But if you think about what that means, it means that since August, we've added $1.3 trillion to the national debt. For some context, the first time the U.S. debt hit $1 trillion total was in 1981. And so think about, you know, U.S. history all the way up until 1981. It took all of that to get to $1 trillion. And this past administration and this past Congress, they did that in about 4 months. And so this, to me, is pretty clear evidence that it's a spending problem. We need to get this spending under control. And to me, it is one of the, if not the single largest problem that's hiding right in plain sight. And so I'm really excited to see, you know, what this incoming administration might do, but they've got a tall task ahead of them.
Let me ask you some, just to put it in context, if you're talking about 36.3 trillion, as you say, it's hard to imagine that much money.
Right.
For our listeners, what does that mean, 36.3 trillion?
Yeah, so $36.3 trillion equates to over $100,000 for every single man, woman, and child in the U.S., right? So if every single person wrote a check to the government for $100,000, that would come close to paying off the national debt, okay? If you look at just the people who are paying taxes, so the taxpayers, it equates to about $220,000 per taxpayer. You can also think of this in some different like physical measures. And so some of my favorites that I went through and did some of the math to try to figure this out. So $36.3 trillion, if I were to get that money in $100 bills and then stack them on top of each other, right? That tower would be 24,431 miles tall.
Now, wow. Not feet, so miles.
Miles, right? So that's an astronomical figure. But when I tell you that the Earth itself has a circumference of about 26 to 27,000 miles at the equator, that means that pile is going all the way around the world. And it will hit, if we continue at our spending levels, we will encircle the globe in $100 bills. And again, not laid end to end. I'm talking stacked flat on top of each other, right? That will encircle the globe by April. You could also think about, you know, how heavy would $36 trillion be if you had them in dollar bills? And the answer is that it would weigh about six times as much as the Hoover Dam. So it'd be something like 37 trillion tons. Right.
Wow.
Not trillion. So 37 million tons.
Incredible.
Yeah. And, you know, if you lay them out the long way, you know, end to end, and you went at the speed of light to try to get from one end to the other, it would take you 5 hours. Right. It's 3.5 billion miles long. Right. So this is just a huge thing. I mean, it's incomprehensible to, you know, people, which is why when we see these programs that say, you know, hey, this is going to cost $800 billion. You know, everyone says, yeah, that sounds like a lot. And that's kind of the end of it, right? So to me, this is just clearly a spending problem. And you can't call this a revenue problem when you're talking about this volume of money.
So let's talk a little bit more about, the context of the debt compared to the size of the American economy, and maybe compared to the size of the federal government's annual budget.
Yeah, so the U.S. GDP is somewhere around $30 trillion per year. So the national debt constitutes more than the U.S. and like the entire U.S. GDP. And what that means, so GDP, we typically think of it as how much stuff is produced, like the dollar value of all the things produced in the U.S. But it's also a measure of every single penny of income that is earned, right? The two have to be identical. And so if you think about it that way, that means that we could tax every single penny of income that every single American earns for an entire year. And we'd have to assume that they would continue to work at a 100% flat tax rate, right? And so if that was all true, we still would not pay off the national debt. And so this is just a huge problem. Now, in terms of the national debt compared to Congress's, you know, revenues. So Congress has revenues every year of roughly $4.7 trillion, but we can round it up to five just to make things easier for ourselves. And that means that you could take every single penny of the federal budget and devote it solely to paying down the debt. And we could even assume that you have no interest, right? So 0% interest on this. And it would take you 7 years of every penny of federal spending to pay this off. Now, then you can look at, you know, the deficit spending, which is the deficit spending is any spending over and above the money that Congress takes in. They've passed a budget pretty much every year, going back to at least the year 2000, planning to spend more money than they take in. Like, that's just in their budget resolution, is that they already plan to spend more money than they think they're going to take in. And so for this upcoming year, they're already projecting another $1.3 to $1.7 trillion in deficit spending, which means that they're already planning to add $1.3 to $1.7 trillion to the national debt just this year alone. Now, I'm working on a project right now comparing their predictions to, you know, reality, what happens, you know, years later. And what will surprise almost no one is that every time Congress predicts, you know, how much more they're going to add to the national debt, they end up adding more, right? And so this is the minimum, is another $1.7 trillion in the federal debt just from this 1 year alone.
Amazing. I think a lot of our listeners, and certainly the general public, hears these numbers. And as you say, until you make it concrete in the way you have, you don't understand the vast magnitude of it. But there clearly would be people who say, well, okay, so since 1981, our national deficit, budget deficits and national debt has been increasing pretty dramatically, almost exponentially. But it doesn't seem to have caused a problem. So there might be some people out there saying, okay, it's big, it's huge, it sounds bad, but really, why does it matter?
Yes. So this is a great question, because at the end of the day, you know, if you look around and you ask Americans, you know, how are you doing in general? You know, we're all going to identify some specific problems here and there. And I certainly don't want to take away from any of that. You know, healthcare is expensive. Housing is expensive. College tuition is expensive, right? All of these things are very high. And we feel those, you know, in our pocketbooks. And so, like, I don't want to dispute, you know, any of that. But to me, the national debt is emblematic of a lot of very serious problems, because what it represents is Congress coming in and effectively borrowing money that reduces the amount of money that's available for private borrowing. So all the money that we borrow, for example, to go to school, to buy a car, to get a mortgage, right? That all comes from, you know, loanable funds markets. And when Congress comes in and is borrowing or is sucking up a lot of those loanable funds for themselves, well, that means that there's less available for you and I, right? And so now we have higher interest rates, we have more difficulty getting, you know, actual private loans, right? And these are things that affect a lot of people. In fact, they disproportionately affect low-income people, irrespective of the fact that some low-income people are not current taxpayers. And so they might not, you know, feel the pinch of the taxation required to pay this deficit off directly. They're feeling it at the bank, at the credit union, when they go to try to take out loan. And this is what's really affecting every single American in a way that is kind of difficult to see, because there's a couple of steps in reasoning that have to get through. But it's, to me, that's the biggest problem. But then the other side of it is to think about how much money we're spending on, how much federal money we're spending servicing the debt. And so right now, the service or the interest payments on our debt is the second largest form or source of payments that Congress makes every single year.
Right? I'm sorry, did you say the second largest?
It is the second, right? So we spend more money in service of the national debt than we do on national defense, right? And by like quite a bit. And that's projected to continue to grow as the national debt continues to grow, as interest rates continue to rise, because the thing about this debt that people aren't quite coming aware of is that for a long time, we had very low interest rates, and that meant that Congress could borrow at those low interest rates too. But as those interest rates have come up, the interest payments on those debt obligations is going to go up as well, even if the total debt itself doesn't change. And so all of this is pointing to a very serious problem, where very quickly we're going to be spending more money on debt than we do on anything else. Now, anyone who's ever struggled with credit card debt, you know, can relate to this. It's very difficult to get yourself out of credit card debt without making massive changes to your lifestyle. And if we were to compare the American household's, you know, budget to Congress's budget and then their, you know, debt ratios, what we'd find is that the typical American would have about $455,000 in credit card debt. Now, this is not mortgage debt. This is credit card debt. And so that to me is the big problem, is you can't possibly sit here and say, you know, if I've got $455,000 in credit card debt, I'm going to run into some serious challenges. And I can't just continue to roll that over again and again and again indefinitely. At some point, that bill is going to come due. And when it does, that's going to necessitate some serious changes that are going to massively affect millions upon millions of American households. And so that's the danger of this problem. It's hiding in plain sight, but no one seems to be willing or excited or able at some level to do anything about it. And it needs to be addressed.
You mentioned before, I think a lot of people would think, well, I can't carry $454,000 worth of credit card debt because nobody will give me that money.
Right.
Nobody will finance my debt. Say a little bit more, if you would, so our listeners understand the situation. How does the federal government finance this national debt?
Yeah, so most of it is financed through the issuing of treasury bonds and other types of debt instruments. And I should say, you know, the U.S., even though our credit rating was just downgraded, if you compare it to the rest of the world, it's still a remarkably safe investment because the U.S., at least until now, has never failed to meet, you know, its debt obligations. We've always paid our debts off, or at least paid the bonds that have come due, right, at their maturation date or the date that their payments is due, right? We've always met those either by extending the money or by offering, you know, to roll over the debt instruments and just let it continue to accrue interest. So those are kind of the two tricks that we use. Is primarily we're rolling over that debt and just saying, you know, hey, we owe you this many dollars, you know, this year. How would you like to just instead take on another, you know, bond from the Treasury? And most borrowers will say yes, because it's a relatively safe investment. You can pull out of it relatively quickly. So it's not that the U.S. has a problem with borrowing money per se, right? But what it does mean is that in future years, when we start paying off those debts, when people stop saying, you know, hey, yeah, I'll roll over my bond, right? When that starts to happen, well, that means that we're going to collect fewer dollars in net tax revenue. So Congress will have even fewer dollars available to actually spend on all the programs that everyone likes, on national defense, on building schools, on roads. And so you look at all the things that Congress has effectively asserted that they have a role in providing, and then you say, all right, now we're going to do it with even fewer dollars. It's going to be really catastrophic. And that's the thing that I'm really trying to get Congress and this incoming, you know, administration and Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy. I want them to be aware that this is an opportunity that they can start to address these problems. They can't solve them. So I want to get that out of everyone's head. We're not going to pay off the national debt during this incoming administration. Can't happen. But we can take steps to sort of rein it in and prevent the catastrophe that is inevitably going to come if we do not address this problem.
In particular, because as you suggest, the system works, the deficit and debt system works if people have confidence that if they buy a U.S. Treasury bond, that the T-bill, that they have confidence that it'll get paid back. It strikes me, based on what you're saying, is if investors around the world, whether they're individuals or institutional investors or governments, if investors lost confidence that the United States was going to pay it back, they could stop buying these T-bills and we could not finance our debt. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, so exactly. As confidence in the ability to repay these T-bills falls, the Congress is going to have to offer even higher interest rates to get people to buy them. But that's just going to exacerbate the problem and lead to even more, you know, problems again. And you're going to find yourself in sort of a debt death spiral where the interest rate that you're going to have to offer is just so high that everyone knows you'll never pay it back. And so you won't be able to borrow money in the first place. And when you have a Congress in a system, it's not just this Congress that just passed. This is the entire federal budget process system is designed around this. When you have a system that rewards borrowing and expects borrowing and that demands at some level that you borrow, and then you suddenly reduce the ability to borrow, all of a sudden, the American people are not going to be getting what they want from the ballot box. They're not going to be getting what they want out of Washington, out of, you know, state capitals, out of anywhere. And it's going to really just affect, you know, a lot of people, particularly the low income people. You know, high income people, you know, they might suffer a little bit, but, you know, they can always afford, you know, different things. It's this trope of, you know, rich people have always been able to pick and choose, you know, what school district they want to live in or where to send their kids to school. Low-income people don't have that kind of a privilege. And so low-income people in particular are going to be just devastated if the investor confidence were to decrease in the ability of Congress and the Treasury to pay back their debts. If that happens, I mean, it's going to be absolutely disastrous.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to take a moment and ask you to learn a little more about the Ashbrook Center and how you can help us continue our work with teachers, students, and citizens.
I'm Chad Kiefer, Director of Philanthropy and Strategic Partnerships here at Ashbrook. At its heart, America's story is about the lives of patriots who have given their last full measure of devotion to preserve and protect what it means to be an American. But the tragic truth is that the American story is being rewritten as one of oppression and despair. Back in 1776, the founders took a chance when they created a new government built on principles of liberty. They took a chance on America. Now I'm challenging you to do the same. Your gift to Ashbrook today reaches students, teachers, and citizens across the country, helping them to understand why America is worthy of their devotion. With so many forces eroding our history and taking away from our principles, isn't it time we give America a chance? Your investment is encouraged now more than ever. Please visit us today at ashbrook.org/support.
Given the magnitude of the problem now, and as you say, the potential very, very serious economic difficulty, and I suppose political difficulty as well, what can be done? You talk about this in your piece. Yep. And as you just mentioned, you start off by saying, let's start by saying what we shouldn't expect.
Right. So we should definitely not expect, you know, total repayment of the national debt anytime soon. That will take, you know, decades of concerted and frankly bipartisan effort. So it's going to be really difficult to find, you know, both parties agreeing on paying off the national debt as the primary, you know, driver of policy.
Because that point struck me importantly when I was reading the piece, because it is true that the spending has been a bipartisan problem.
Right.
In some respects, it hasn't mattered in many ways which party has been in control of Congress or if it's been divided government. The spending right. continues to outpace revenue.
Yes. That's the system, you know, doing its job, frankly. So part of the issue to me, the first thing that I think we should do is that we should eliminate the debt ceiling. But what I mean by that is not what, you know, President-elect Trump means in the sense that therefore Congress can borrow unlimited money. The debt ceiling was first established in 1917 with the Second Liberty Bond Act. And the idea behind it was basically that Congress got sick and tired of being asked, you know, constantly by the Treasury and the Department of War to borrow money to finance World War I, right? So it used to be the case that if the Treasury needed to borrow money, they had to go and ask Congress for each item that they wanted to buy, right? And so Congress would then have to take action. They would have to meet, they would have to convene. It was a very, you know, onerous process. And that put a serious limit on borrowing because Congress just didn't want to deal with it, right? They said, no, like, we're not going to entertain this. We have other things that we want to do. And so, no, you can't borrow money, right? So that kept borrowing in check, you know, pretty strongly. What happened in 1917 is because of the war, and I'm not one of those people that will say, you know, we should never borrow money. I certainly don't think that's true. I think there are very legitimate reasons to go into national debt, provided that you have a plan to pay it off. But what Congress did in 1917 is they said, look, you know, a world war is a legitimate thing to borrow money for. We're kind of busy right now, so we're just going to pre-approve the Treasury to borrow this many dollars, right? And that became the very first debt ceiling, right? And so they just had authorization to borrow up until a certain amount, and then they could come back to Congress and say, hey, you know, we need a little bit more, and Congress could increase it then, right? So it was originally, the debt ceiling was originally meant to save Congress time on deliberation during war. It was not meant to be a, you know, forever and ever we're allowed to borrow this many dollars, right? That was not its intent. It's been morphed into that. And now we see, you know, games of political chicken where people are threatening to shut down the government if we don't raise or suspend the debt ceiling, right? And all kinds of stuff. And we're gearing up for that fight again, right? I mean, it's going to come in a couple of weeks, I think. So, you know, that's going to be a whole new storm of drama and, you know, name blaming and finger pointing and grandstanding that, you know, as a public finance guy, I'm excited to watch. But as a taxpayer, I'm not excited to see. Right. So I think the first step would be eliminating the debt ceiling and returning to an effective $0 debt ceiling that then has to be, you know, acted on by Congress to allow specific items to be paid for with debt. The second thing, we have to tackle entitlement reform. Now, or I'm sorry, we have to tackle entitlement in general. It is the case, as I say in the piece, that, you know, too many people are getting too many dollars for too many things in the U.S. right now. Now, this doesn't mean that I don't have a heart and that I want to see people suffer. But the issue that I see is the compliance costs. So if we tell people that have, you know, a certain SNAP benefits, for example, that you can buy, you know, this chicken, but not that chicken. Well, I have to have someone monitor that. And that person is expensive. And so we can save on a lot of costs, not necessarily by reducing the things that people can buy with their food, but by essentially making it easier on Congress and the department's, you know, behalf to check the compliance, right? I don't particularly care what brand of chicken nuggets someone buys with their SNAP benefits. And it, you know, it's hard for me to imagine a Washington bureaucrat caring about that either. So just let anyone buy whatever brand of chicken nuggets they want with their SNAP benefits. And then you can save on the compliance costs, the compliance administration costs, you know, as you see fit. So there are ways to make, you know, what Congress does more efficient. That's what, you know, DOGE or the Department of Government Efficiency is supposed to do. The challenge there is Trump has already promised very little, if any, reforms for about 85% of the federal budget. And so now we're just carping about 15% of the overall budget. That's not really going to move the needle. Even if you eliminated all of it, you're still going to be adding to the national debt. The other issue that I see is the way that these issues are talked about in general. So we hear, you know, especially during the campaign, we hear candidates would say, you know, my plan is going to save $2 trillion over the next 10 years. And everyone thinks like, oh, it's going to save $2 trillion over the next 10 years. That means the national debt's going to go from 36 to 34, right? That's what everyone thinks it means. But what it really means is you're going to have a national debt that grows $2 trillion fewer than it would without their plan. So right now, the CBO, the Congressional Budget Office, has put out their predictions. And so their baseline is that by 2034, the national debt will be somewhere around $50 to $52 trillion. And so when we say, like, hey, my tax plan or my plan is going to save $2 trillion, what it means is that they're predicting that the national debt will only grow to $50 trillion. It's not that it will be reduced. It's that the growth rate will be reduced. And think about what that means, right? We're bragging about reducing the growth rate of a massive number. Think about, you know, Bill Clinton when he had divided Congress and he, you know, balanced the budget and everyone heralded him as a fiscal wizard. It's like, well, he just balanced the budget. Like, I balance my budget every year. Somehow I don't go into massive debt all the time, right? And so this is the weird thing. So those are the issues that I think need to be clearly made to the minds of the American people, especially around election time, is like, this is what we're actually talking about. This is what it means. And this is how this system actually works.
So it strikes me as, for example, the point you made about entitlement reform, that's an economic problem, which, as you say, 85% of the entitlements are not being talked about. And presumably what those 85% consists of is things like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. Is that right?
Right. Yeah, it's about 85% is Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, and then a separate category in the budget just called health, which does not include Medicare and Medicaid. It's an entirely separate budget item.
So you're saying, and of course, again, that's been called the third rail of American politics. You yep. don't touch that. George W. Bush, as I recall, said something about that in his inaugural address in 2005 and immediately lost a lot of political capital with that. Both parties, neither political party, seems frankly to be talking about and reforming those kind of entitlements. If you were to give some suggestions for that kind of entitlement reform, just broadly speaking, what would you say?
Yeah, so I mean, some of the easy ones, at least to me, would be to move away from, you know, specific things that are covered under entitlement and just move to cash payments, right? So a lot of those times, this is called a universal basic income. Andrew Yang called it a freedom dividend. But the benefit of this is that you don't have to monitor what people do with the money. You just give them the money and let them make their own choices about, you know, what they're going to do with it. And you trust at some level that they're going to do, you know, the right thing with it. Now, I'm certainly not going to sit here and argue that a universal basic income is the greatest policy solution to all of society's ills. I don't believe that one bit. But it can be administered a lot more cheaply than the current system. And that's the issue that I want to try to focus on with this, right? Is the unsung, you know, villain in a lot of stories isn't necessarily the spending that's going to the American people. It's the cost of getting that money to the American people, right? We're reminded about, you know, international aid efforts and how expensive it is, you know, just to get food over to a different part of the world, right? And just how costly that is. And if I can make it easier to get, you know, resources from point A to point B, I can actually make people's lives much, much better and at a much lower cost, right? And so that's the issue that I think is a valid one. Now, some of my colleagues at, you know, AIER disagree with me on that. And that's why I love working here, is there's such a diverse, you know, set of people and, you know, we'll have great discussions like we've had all week, you know, during our week-long meeting today. But it's an issue that compliance is just huge. Think about all the field officers all over the country whose only job is to make sure that people are buying, you know, hot chicken and not cold chicken, who are buying, you know, certain brands of yogurt and not different brands, right? And then think about on the other side, you know, the crony capitalist measures that had to go into picking, you know, which brand of yogurt is allowed to be purchased with these, you know, entitlements and programs, right? So think about the lobbying dollars that had to be spent by, you know, the Go-Gurt, right? Or any of the other, you know, brands of yogurt that exist, right? Or Oikos, right? They had to lobby Congress. They had to pay their lobbyists a lot of money. They had to give a lot of gifts, a lot of, you know, campaign contributions. Well, all that's money that isn't really going to producing anything. That's just money that's going towards steering the political ship, right? And if I take away all of that and I just let people buy whatever yogurt they want, whatever chicken nuggets they want, right? Now, all of a sudden, all that lobbying money can go back to the company in the form of, you know, not costs, and they can bring prices down, make everything more affordable for people, right? And everyone can have more of the things that they want without actually touching, you know, the overall effect of the entitlement or the reception of the entitlement programs. And so this is where it's kind of thorny to get into the weeds on that one. And then, you know, as you're kind of seeing those changes happen, what you can do is you can gradually start reducing those overall, you know, payments and return things, frankly, to the private charity world that they were in, you know, before all of these programs. And so there's a lot of things that can be done that I think would be fairly straightforward and fairly simple and would save a lot of money out of the congressional purse. The challenge then, of course, is, you know, you're upsetting the status quo. You're trying to change, you know, and do things kind of going upstream from the political winds that prevail. And so it's a really challenging thing. I don't want to sound doom and gloom and you know, throw my hands up and say this is impossible. But at the same time, you know, we have to recognize the world that we're in, and we have to try to operate within that world.
Some people, in response, as you know, in response to the world we're in and the rapidly increasing national debt, have argued that if you look back at other times in American history, you'll see that economic growth, if it really takes off, creates so much more prosperity that federal government takes in more revenue through taxation because of the increasing, the bigger economic pie. And that essentially what people, some people have tried to argue is we can grow our way out of the national debt. What do you think about that argument?
Yeah, it's a great, like, it's a great theory. And I really hope it were true. The unfortunate reality is we are constrained to producing, you know, only a certain amount of stuff, not because there's only so much space or finite resources. But if you think about, you know, to produce anything in the US, you have to have people, you have to have space, you have to have capital. And so we can measure, you know, how much more stuff could we produce by looking at, for example, the unemployment rate. And so if the unemployment rate is low, that means that we're using all of our resources pretty effectively. It's pretty tough to get growth when you don't have the ability to hire people away and find, you know, a way to sort of have a new entrepreneurial spirit. And so what happens with this deficit spending that we're doing is it actually encourages people to buy imports, right? So this whole like trade deficit issue that everyone's, you know, talking about right now is at some level determined or caused by the deficit spending at a time when we have very full employment. My colleague here at AIER, Dave Rose, has a wonderful piece up on our website from a few weeks ago going into length about this, discussing, you know, how this deficit spending is actually causing the trade deficits that we're having and experiencing all of with countries all over the world. And so it's really hard to just cause economic growth, right? You can't just flip a switch or turn up a dial, right? The president-elect might have a red button to summon a Diet Coke, but he doesn't have a red button to increase GDP growth rates by 0.5%, right? And I wish he did, and I wish he would press that button furiously, but he doesn't. And so the idea that we're going to grow our way out of this problem seems pretty unlikely. You know, it's one of those things that everyone's kind of said will happen at some point. We did see a little bit of it after World War II. So debt to GDP ratios during and toward the end of World War II were extraordinarily high, and they came down pretty quickly after World War II ended. Now, part of that is because we reduced spending on, you know, the military as a result of the end of World War II. But a big part of it, and what goes unsung, is that we also saw a massive increase in GDP as, you know, one, soldiers returned from war and went back to work, but also the rise of women in the workforce as a result of the men being shipped off to fight the war. Women stepped up, you know, Rosie the Riveter, right? And so what happened is you effectively doubled the labor force right after World War II. Well, when you have twice as many people working, you're going to get a lot more output. And that means a lot more GDP. And so the debt to GDP ratio fell as a result of, one, the war effort being over and women entering the workforce at an extraordinarily high rate in the, you know, preceding years and staying in the workforce, right? And so I don't know if we're going to be able to grow out of this problem, right? Everyone talks about that, but it seems extraordinarily unlikely. And it seems like every time we've been able to do that in the past, there's been a mitigating factor that actually explains it.
Well, that's an interesting point, because I was thinking that some of our listeners who are pretty historically informed, many of them, would say, look, it's not as though the national debt has never been a problem before now or before 1981. We had a national debt issue was really important in the American founding and the creation of the Constitution, right? Yeah. And then throughout the 19th century and periods in the 20th century, we've had bursts of national debt, and then the national debt has gone back down. And I think some of our listeners might be wondering, why isn't that true this time? Why aren't we going to see a debt cycle where the debt goes up, but then goes back down again? Why is this different?
We are kind of living through a third era, if you will. So we think about like the agricultural revolution, we think about the industrial revolution, and there's a great, you know, book by Mike Munger called Tomorrow 3.0 that discusses this idea of right now being sort of the platform or the sharing revolution, where instead of owning a bunch of things, we all kind of rent them at some level. So think about like the rise of Uber is kind of the classic example. You know, I own a car, but I could, if I didn't have kids, I could probably get away with not owning a car and not having to make those, you know, monthly payments on my car loan, and instead just Uber the couple times per week that I actually have to drive somewhere. Right. And I could save a bunch of money, and that person could get more use out of their asset. And so we are in the midst of what Munger calls a massive revolution. And those can be painful, and those can be, you know, challenging. But it's going to be really difficult, especially with Congress. And this is both parties right now being sort of avoiding economic progress. So think about like the longshoremen strike a few weeks ago, where they wanted to ban, you know, automation at the ports to protect the longshoremen's jobs. Well, okay, you can do that, but that just means you're going to keep the cost of operating our ports very, very high. And if it's very, very expensive to operate ports, which means it's very expensive to ship, right, into and out of this country, that's a huge cost that's going to be added to the American people, right? You compare the ports in the US to the ports in, for example, China, and Chinese ports are absolutely like decimating us. They're so much more productive. They're heralded as some of the most productive ports in the entire world, right? Now, part of it is because they have a lot of people that they can throw at that problem, and labor is historically and famously cheap there. But at the same time, they're also allowing technology and capital to enter into that shipping world. So when you have a incoming administration and frankly an outgoing administration as well, that were both very much against economic progress, it becomes even more unlikely that you're going to grow your way out. In the past, economic progress was viewed as this wonderful thing. Today's, you know, milieu, if you will, seems to be that we have enough, we just need to distribute it better. And this is where, you know, the rights version of tariffs, of, you know, incentivizing manufacturing jobs, you know, of sacrificing. I mean, I was asked recently, you know, would you sacrifice 1% GDP growth per year in order to secure more manufacturing jobs in the US? And I said no. And the reason is because 1% GDP growth per year is a huge share of our GDP growth. I mean, we're hitting, you know, maybe 2.4%. So you drop me down to 1.4%, I've cut growth in half, essentially. And the wonderful thing about compound interest is that when you can compound that growth over, you know, 30, 40 years, we could be talking about, you know, doubling standard of living for everyone. So no, I would not, you know, reduce GDP growth by 1% in order to redistribute what we have now. I think we should try to grow, but it's very difficult to cause that to happen. It's very easy to prevent it from happening, but to cause it from happening and then to plan on it happening is arrogance at its finest, if I'm being completely frank about it.
All right. There have been examples around the world, as you mentioned in your piece, of governments who have gone into a debt death spiral, is what you call it. Yep. You're saying right now you don't foresee that for the United States, where we still have, of course, a dynamic economy. We still have a growing GDP, if not growing fast enough. And we still have confidence in T-bills and confidence in the dollar as sort of the reserve currency of the world. Given those factors, I think a lot of our listeners would say, is there any good news? Is there any hope for honest grappling with the national debt?
Yeah. So I do want to, you know, really underscore what you said there. I do firmly believe that the American economy is robust to any amount of government stupidity. You know, we are some of the most productive and most industrious people in the entire world. We just need to be unleashed to do the work that we can do. And so I don't see the U.S. entering a deficit death spiral anytime soon. So this isn't a doom and gloom situation. So this is a situation where if you see like General Motors and Chevrolet and the reduction in their pension programs from, you know, 20 years ago, that wiped out a whole lot of people's retirement programs. I mean, these are things that people had planned on. And so that was an avoidable problem. And the avoidable problem isn't saying that you don't make promises that you can't keep. It's saying that you can take a small step today to avoid massive catastrophe in the future. And we're getting really close to losing the opportunity to start taking those small steps and getting very close to having to take big leaps to solve this national debt problem. So I would rather us have, you know, the difficult, and they will be difficult conversations, but they won't be catastrophic conversations if we start having them now. And they can be avoided. The cliff can be avoided. You can turn away from it. But right now, Congress seems to be not just steering toward the cliff, but hitting the gas pedal. And I'm just the guy that says, like, hey, maybe we should like hit the brakes, or maybe we should turn either direction, right, and avoid the cliff. Or even better yet, throw the car into reverse. That'd be amazing. We can get further from the cliff. And so I think that we're getting really dangerously close to the cliff. We're not there yet, and there's still time to turn the wheel. But if we continue down this road, it's going to end in us driving off the cliff, and that's going to be an absolute disaster. And again, it's going to be a disastrous, particularly for the low income and least advantaged in the U.S.
Well, sobering words, but important words for us to hear as citizens who care about the future of this country, and of course, public officials charged with caring for the well-being of the country. Dave Hebert, thank you for your insights. Thank you for the conversation today. Thanks for taking the time to join us on The American Idea.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.